people don't give away their children unless they believe their child's survival or salvation depends on it.
Hi, I'm Sylvia Beckerman. Join me today as I talk to an extraordinary woman who is changing the world by making a difference in her life and the lives of those around her.
Hi, I'm Gretchen Sisson. I'm a sociologist at Advancing New Standards in Reproductive Health, which is at the University of California in San Francisco. And welcome to Sylvia and me.
Gretchen, thank you so much for taking the time to be with me here today, because we're going to have a conversation on such an important topic that, as you said just a few minutes ago, that more people are open to talking about. Before we do, I want to go a little bit into not only your background, but who you are, because you're not just a sociologist. You're Dr. Gretchen Sisson. You're a sociologist who studies adoption and abortion in the U.S. Your studies on adoption include hundreds of in-depth interviews with women who have relinquished infants for domestic adoption over the past 60 years, with a particular focus on women who have relinquished since Roe v. Wade. And your research has been cited in the Supreme Court's dissent in Dobbs v. Jackson Women's Health from Justices Breyer, Kagan, and Sotomayor. You've also been, authored in pieces in the Washington Post, The Nation, NPR's All Things Considered, Consider This, and quite a bit more. Just a couple of more things about you. You're an active member of the Women's Donors Network and served as a member of the founding board of directors, and you're co-founder of the Abortion Bridge Collaboration Fund, which is a movement-led rapid response trust-based philanthropy effort to address the post-Dobbs needs in abortion provision and protection across the country. You are the author of Relinquished: The Politics of Adoption and the Privilege of American Motherhood. I have one more thing that I want to read before we get into it. Adoption is often spoken of as an alternative to abortion, but is little examined for all realities. Relinquished takes it on, and in so doing, contributes to our national understanding of what reproductive justice really means. That was Gloria Steinem's response to Relinquished. So I want to get into exactly your research, which took over a decade, 10 years. And from what I understand, a lot of this started back in 2009-2010, sparked by MTV and their program at the time, 16 and Pregnant. Can you tell us why that kind of sparked a study that took 10 years?
So it was sparked by a lot. I guess there were a lot of things that were kind of the kindling that went into this. And MTV was just kind of the final spark that really set off this project, which in its early form, I don't think I could have predicted exactly that it would lead us to where it has with this book. But at the time I was in graduate school, I was based in Boston. I was doing a number of different things. I was volunteering with a local abortion fund in Boston. I was doing my master's thesis that was particularly looking at infertility and that side of reproductive health. And I was also interning with an organization called the Massachusetts Alliance on Teen Pregnancy. And we were working with pregnant and parenting young mothers who were really trying to push back on these stigmatizing ideas we have about teen moms. They were doing a lot of lobbying work to change the pregnant and parenting student policy in Boston public schools and to get more support generally across the Commonwealth for themselves and their children. And they were so inspiring to me, right? The work that they were doing to raise their children, to support their families, and to find dignity in a world that really shames them for the choices that they've made. And I was really impressed by it, but it was really the intersection of working with these young mothers, working on the abortion fund, doing this research on infertility, that kind of made me recognize these themes of how we understand adoption, right? Adoption can kind of solve all these problems, quote problems, right? So if we have adoption available, people don't need to have access to abortion. If we have adoption available, we can just take the children from these young, mostly low-income, pretty poor mothers and transfer them to these middle-class, mostly white, heteronormative families, and like problem solved, right? We don't need to really engage in what it means to provide abortion access at a meaningful level. We don't need to engage in what it means to make infertility treatments accessible to more people in a way that they can afford. We certainly don't need to engage in what it means to invest in vulnerable families at a level that lets them care for their kids in the way they want to. And this was all really driven home because this was the summer that MTV started airing 16 and Pregnant. And on that first season, each episode followed a different young mother through her pregnancy, birth, and early days of parenthood. And this show was intentionally trying to be deeply stigmatizing about teen pregnancy and young motherhood, right? And that was what the content creators acknowledged. They were trying to use this as a way to prevent teen pregnancy by making it look so stigmatized and so terrible that teenagers would be more intentional about their pregnancy planning. But there was one couple on that first season that relinquished their daughter, Tyler and Caitlin, and their daughter, Carly, was relinquished in adoption, and it followed their early arc. And really, the underlying story that kind of came out was that Caitlin and Tyler are better parents than all these other mothers we've had on the show. They're more mature. They're more responsible. They're more caring for their child because they have given up their own parenthood. And that was really the message, that teenagers are so incapable as parents that adoption is kind of the only way for them to redeem themselves. And that, to me, looking at these young mothers that I was working with, who were so powerful, going to such lengths to fight for what they needed to take care of their families and their children. And it really drove home the way these cultural narratives about adoption aren't actually reflective of people's actual lived experiences. And so I wanted to look more closely at the mothers who do relinquish children for adoption. Why they make that choice? Why didn't they have abortions if they were facing an unplanned pregnancy? What kind of makes them different from, because they're a very relatively small group. What makes them make that choice? And then what does that mean over the course of their lives and their child's life? So that sort of sparked the study. But there were a lot of things kind of happening that really drove home for me the ways that our cultural stories about adoption aren't really rooted in what it actually looks like.
Well, you know, one of the things is, and you've noted this in the book, in fact, you have a chapter on myths, is the fact that it's always seen on any movies or television shows how the birth mother, whether a teenager or someone who can't afford to have their children or someone who was forced into giving birth because they were raped and they can't get an abortion, that they're doing such a great justice in basically giving up their child, because they, you know, what people don't actually focus on is the fact that this woman, however old, has actually gone through 9 months of pregnancy. That child has been a part of them for 9 months. It's not a question where, oh, I found it, you know, baby. And it's really fantastic that people who cannot have children are able to adopt. I have that in my family, where that has taken place, and it's been a blessing. But what we're talking about here is the reproductive justice and how we frame adoption and the people giving up their child for adoption. So I'd like to focus on that. And when we say reproductive justice, can you go into what that terminology, what we're really talking about?
Mm-hmm. I mean, so the core, you know, theory and movement of reproductive justice is really rooted in, you know, Black women and their organizing kind of in the early 90s. And it was really in a response to this idea of a reproductive rights movement that was largely about legal access to abortion care. And reproductive justice is this more proactive framework of what it means to make pregnancy choices and also what it means to raise your children in safe and sustainable communities, right? And it's, so it's a much more intersectional framework for understanding how people become pregnant, are pregnant, make choices about their pregnancies, and then embrace their families. And so I think that adoption fits very well into this because it considers the circumstances under which people choose to relinquish their children. And I always say that people don't give away their children unless they believe their child's survival or salvation depends on it, right? And I say salvation because there's a lot of religious practice in the shape of adoption in the United States today. And I say survival because, as I spoke with mothers, the defining characteristic for most of their stories was really poverty. And I think poverty, not in that they couldn't, they were sort of the poorest of the poor, but poverty in that they didn't have a living wage, they didn't have a stable job, they didn't have a safe living environment for the baby, and they didn't have, they needed relatively little amounts of money to stabilize their lives, but they didn't have enough to leave that crappy boyfriend and get their own apartment and put a safety deposit down. They didn't have enough to buy a car that would enable them to, you know, get to and from work in way with the baby. You know, they didn't have the resources that they needed to buy a car seat in some cases, right? These sort of basic things. And for a lot of them, these sort of relatively small gaps in being able to get from where they were, which was a pregnancy that they hadn't planned, weren't quite sure what to do with, and the vision for what they needed to be stable with a child was too big. They couldn't navigate that gap, even though I usually ask them, how much would you have needed to parent? The highest number I heard was $5,000, right?
Isn't that amazing? And that's, those are the stories that we do not hear, especially in today's age, with what has been going on and with the overturn of Roe v. Wade, for some of the justices to actually say that there's adoption.
Yeah,
so you can't get an abortion, you can adopt, you can put your child up for adoption. That's not an equal choice here.
Right. Well, and we... So there's two ways of looking at this, right? There are the women who relinquished their child and did want to have an abortion. They tried to get an abortion. They either couldn't afford one or they couldn't get one. And all of my interviews were before the Dobbs decision. So abortion was legal, technically legal in every state, but for some of them, they couldn't access it. It was too far away. Then there were women who never tried to get an abortion. Sometimes they found out very late in their pregnancy that they were pregnant. That was definitely a recurring theme. They found out they were pregnant. They were already 22, 23 weeks. Or, excuse me, or they didn't want to have, they didn't have any interest in having an abortion. And that was actually the majority of them. And they felt bonded to their pregnancy right away. They were, and most of them wanted to parent. They continued their pregnancies because they intended to parent. And it wasn't until the end of their pregnancy that that felt impossible to them. And so I think it's important to understand it was a minority of birth mothers that have ever even tried to get an abortion. Most of them want to parent at the time. So the contrast between abortion and adoption isn't a relevant conversation for them. They wanted to parent. They intended to be pregnant. They didn't try to have an abortion. On the flip side, it's when you look at the people who want to have an abortion and can't get one, most of them will parent. So we know this from the Turnaway study, which looked at people who wanted to have an abortion, weren't able to get one. Of that group of people, 91% of them were parenting the child to which they gave birth, right? right? So the vast majority of people denied access to abortion care are going to be parenting that child. Only 9% were relinquishing. Now, and I know you spoke with my colleague, Diana Greene Foster, about the Turnaway study when her book came out a couple years ago. When we found this 9%, Diana's looking at the 91 and saying 100% of these people did not want to parent. They wanted to have an abortion. So this 9% seems really, really small for why isn't it higher? And I'm looking at the overall population, which has 0.5% of women will relinquish a child. And I'm like, oh, it's astronomical, right? And so I think you have these kind of competing ways of looking at it, right? And so when people talk about if we ban abortion, will the adoption numbers go up? And the answer is yes and no. They will go up, right? But they won't go up as much as you think they will. They'll go up because the numbers of adoption are actually pretty small in this country. So even a low nominal increase will be a huge proportionate increase, right? And because the number of people who need abortions are so much higher, right? But it won't go up that much because we know it's only about that 9 to 10%. And that's actually the same as the proportion of women that face this pre-Roe. So back in the 70s, when we look at relinquishment rates, this is pretty consistent. So that was a long roundabout answer, but I think it's important to understand that when we contrast abortion and adoption, that's not actually how people are making pregnancy decisions. People who want abortions don't want to be pregnant. Right. People who are relinquishing want to parent. What you're dealing with in both equations is an increased number of people who are parenting under conditions that they didn't plan or intend.
And that's, you know, that's a big deal. And from what you just said, there's the flip side on the people who are not parenting and wanted to and gave their child up for adoption because they couldn't, as you said, they couldn't support, and what they would need in order to support was minimal when you take a look at the big scale. In the book, you have a story about a young woman who she had to sell everything to go back home to her parents. And she had a stepdad who just had a truck that you couldn't put a car seat in. And it was just little things like that. How was she going to take care of this child that she was going to give birth to? And so the child was put up for adoption. And then you have young women who are told by their religious leaders that the thing to do to really to be a good parent is to give up the child for adoption. Mm-hmm. Do that, and you are being you're the best parent around. You know, we've talked about some of the inequalities and how so many of the people who give, who cannot parent, who don't have the, you know, they're living in whether it be poverty or they don't have the means, they don't have the support to raise a child. Yet there are tax credits for people who adopt, but there's nothing that helps someone who is at a stage where they can't even get a car seat, where they have worked, they're trying to do what they can. Childcare is not available. They need, you know, food and so on. They might have a job, but how are they going to go to their job if they can't get proper childcare? So it's just it's like a catch-22. But we do give tax credits to people who adopt.
Right. And I think, the federal tax credit for private adoption right now is $16,000 per adoption, right? Whereas most of the women that I interviewed, their adoptions wouldn't have happened if they had an extra $1,000, right? Like one time, like just to be able to kind of get through that crisis. maybe that's optimistic, right? They probably would have needed some more sustained support. But the adoption credits are so high. And really what you're talking about is just increasing the demand for adoption, right? So this is the other thing that people think. People think that there are a lot of children out there in need of adoption in the United States. And when it comes to infant adoption, you have 45 waiting families for every infant that's relinquished. And when we talk about the private adoption system, that's primarily what we're talking about. So there's no reason to subsidize private infant adoption in the US. There are plenty of parents that are hoping to take those children. And yet we do, we subsidize it at a really high level. There are also federal and state subsidies for public for public adoption, foster care adoption, adoption from the state. And even in those circumstances, what we found is if you moderately increase social supports for families, if you increase spending on food support for families by 5%, you see a 14% decrease in foster care child placements, right? Because a lot of children are in foster care for neglect cases because their parents can't afford food, can't afford safe childcare while they're at work. So if you invest in families, you're really going to be averting a lot of foster care and child welfare placements. You're also going to be probably virtually eliminating private adoption. Not in all cases, but in many. If you give people a path to raise the children that they want to raise, they're going to take it. I do want to say, though, that not all of the women in the book were like desperately poor. Right? There were a few, for sure. But a lot of them had support. They had really middle class or higher upbringings, but they didn't have access to their own resources and their own money, right? They were reliant on their parents for that level of support, and their parents were not supportive of them parenting. For a number of reasons. Some of them didn't want their child to be parenting at all. One woman that I interviewed, she was young. She already had a child. She was 19. She had a toddler. She was pregnant again. And she's like, my parents were really supportive during my first pregnancy, but they just did not want me to raise this child. And I can't imagine why. And then later she's like, oh, maybe it's because the baby's father was Black. And I was like, oh yeah, maybe. Right. Like, so you can see the ways that like, it's not entirely about money, right? Like all of the cultural forces that shape our experience today, religion, for sure, race hugely, right. Are kind of shaping these experiences. So I don't want to paint them all as a monolith, but I will say that financial resources were the number one recurring theme and access to their own financial power.
Well, then that's big. And as you said, we were talking about the difference, white middle class women who are pregnant and those who are not white middle class or not white. How do you see that in the studies that you've done?
Yeah, so historically, private adoption has almost been entirely white women participating, and there are a number of reasons for that. One is that communities of color, particularly Black communities, have longer had traditions of single motherhood, of kinship support outside of the immediate family, and so there were spaces to go for that. So Black mothers were very unlikely to relinquish, as were Latina mothers. But also there was a market for white children. And so when we look at the maternity home system pre-Roe in the 1950s, 60s, beginning of the 70s, you see a really concerted effort by the Catholic Church, somewhat the Evangelical Church at the time, to really police the non-marital motherhood of white women because there was a market. There was a high demand for those white children. There was less of a demand for children of color, particularly Black children. That's changed. And sociologist Elizabeth Raleigh has written an entire brilliant book called Selling Transracial Adoption that looks at sort of the rise of international adoption and children of color and international adoption, and now the rise of foster care placements, which are disproportionately children of color. So that has changed. But I think that historically, private adoption was really white women, and that really continued kind of through the early 90s. Today, there is more participation from women of color in the private adoption system, again, because I think poverty and money are really the overriding factors in determining who relinquishes. But I will say there, most of the women in my sample were white, which I think is representative of most birth mothers today. But that doesn't mean that they're relinquishing white children, right? There were a lot of biracial children of color that were being relinquished in these adoptions. And particularly, there's a couple of dynamics there. Often, white relinquishing mothers of biracial children won't think about what their child needs in an adoptive family as a biracial child, right? So that becomes a transracial adoption, and they don't necessarily have the ability to help their child navigate that. They might be very happy putting their child with an entirely white family in an entirely white community where that biracial child is the only child of color in their elementary school class, for example. So white mothers that I interviewed weren't particularly cognizant of that. And then if they're in an open adoption with their child, and again, this is a biracial child, few of the birth fathers were in really active relationships with their child. So the child could have a relationship with their birth mother. They could have an open adoption, but it's really only with the white part of their birth family. And so you're really looking at, it's a disservice to children who are really surrounded by whiteness and don't have anybody thinking about what that means for them over the course of their lives. On the other hand, I did see women of color who were relinquishing, who were like, I'm a Black woman. This is a Black baby. I'm only going to choose adoption if I can find a Black family for them. And the agencies are like, well, we don't have any Black families. And they don't seem particularly motivated to go find Black families. And so it's like, oh, okay, well, I can't have a Black family. So at least these white parents have already adopted a Black child, so they won't be the only Black child that they see growing up. Or one mother that I interviewed, she was herself a transracial adoptee. She's a Latina background. She's like, well, I definitely don't want them to have only white parents because I grew up only in a white community. It was uncomfortable for me. So I'm going to put them with parents of color. Okay, the only parents of color that the adoption agency offers me are people who are Indian, like Southeast Asian Indian by heritage. So you have this Latina child raised in a Southeast Indian household in a white community, because that was all, you know. And so there's this really complex negotiation of what race means, of who's thinking about race, and what's available for prospective adoptive parents. And I think it becomes really complicated. And we haven't, as private adoption has become less overall white as an institution, as we have an increase in transracial adoption in the United States pretty consistently over the last 20 years, I don't think that we've really thought about what that means for the adopted person as they grow up, and how that changes the relationships between birth families and the adoptee.
So. And that's huge. I mean, that's something that really needs to be looked at, because you are doing a disservice to the child in so many ways. And It's something that really needs to be addressed. So you followed these women for 10 years.
Most of them, yes.
Okay. Tell me a couple of women. How did they regret? Did they have any regrets? Would they have kept their child if they had known certain things? Why don't you just give a couple of examples?
Yeah. So, it's not great. and I think that is really important to understand, is that, you can find birth mothers who are absolutely delighted with their decision, enthusiastically so, effusively so. And I did. I when I started the interviews in 2010, I found a number of women who were like, every adoption should look like mine. This is so wonderful. We have an excellent open relationship. Wonderful. And I would talk with those women 10 years later, and they would be like, this adoption should never have happened. Right. And I think that all of the optimism early on is rooted in a couple things. One, like a really robust openness that meets their expectations. They haven't been disappointed yet. Two, they are still in a similar place in their life early on where they were when they made the decision, right? So if they are a 21-year-old college student who is struggling and trying to pay tuition and they can't make it work, well, when I talk to them 2 years later, they're kind of in the same place so that the decision still kind of resonates and makes sense. When I talk with them 10 years later, it's, oh, I could have gotten through those really hard first 2 years somehow and be in a much better place. A lot of them have other children that they do parent pretty soon thereafter, right? So within 3 or 4 years, they're in a place where they can raise a child. Now, you know, hindsight is maybe optimistic. Like, what would it have taken to get through those 2 years? They probably could have done it. Most people do, can parent under pretty hard circumstances. And so by the time they get to 10 years, they're a much more critical place about the adoption. A lot of times the openness isn't meeting what they hoped for. In some cases, the adoptive parents have completely cut off contact. In some cases, it's just far more limited and not the relationship that they wanted with their child. Or that they were, not just that they wanted, but that they were counseled throughout their pregnancy and early in their adoption to expect, right? Openness is really a big part of that early adoption process. You get to pick the parents. You get to have the relationship. It'll be as open as you want at a lot of these agencies. And so it's not just like, oh, I wanted to see my, like they're told that they can expect this. And rarely are those expectations met and managed in the way that they hope. So that sours over time. And again, they're also parenting other children a lot of times, and they just say like, I could have one more right here. I can feed another mouth at this point. Or, you know, one woman, she got pregnant in a bad relationship. She started dating the man who would go on to become her husband, like in her 8th month of pregnancy, actually. And she relinquished and she's like, you know, I had just met him like a few months sooner, like he would have been a great stepdad. Like he has a great relationship with my children, you know? And so I think that like for some of them, circumstances change really quickly and the adoption no longer makes sense. So the 10-year interviews were, I think, really important because they show kind of how quickly people's life circumstances change. And it's, regret is a really strong word, right? Because it means that they wish that they could kind of undo what they did. And I spoke with some women who were like, well, if I hadn't relinquished my child, would I have the children that I have now? Would I be in this relationship? And so you're kind of asking them to choose between kind of these counterfactuals. And one mother who was in exactly that situation said, I want all my children with me. I don't see how that would have happened, right? Like in her biography, her children felt kind of mutually exclusive in some ways, right? If she hadn't relinquished her first child, she wouldn't have the second child that she has. But it's hard for her to say, I regret that choice that I made because I am happy with the life that I have now, but I do wish I had all my children with me, right? And I think that's hard. What we did find as part of the Turnaway study is that the women who did want to have an abortion and weren't able to get one, the mothers who relinquished were most regretful that they weren't able to get their abortions. More so than the mothers who were parenting. So regret is definitely a factor across the board. And I want to be clear, you know, when I'm critical of adoption, people sometimes think that I'm like imposing motherhood on people, right? That I want to force people to be parents. And, you know, unlike anti-abortion people, like I'm not trying to prevent people from making choices. I'm not trying to say like adoption should be illegal, right? And I think that people are allowed to make decisions that they're going to have really complex feelings about that they might come to regret over time. But I do think that it's important to understand what the arc of those stories look like for the mothers who have been there.
And I think I was going to ask you what you hope to get out of, you know, people reading your book. And I think you just said it. And really, people should have knowledge of what it really means to put your child up for adoption, what open adoption is, and what really takes place, and really how are you going to feel, and not let other circumstances just smother you, and the marketing and all these, you know, ideas of open adoption. And because once an adoption is legal and it's final, you really don't have much say.
I mean, you have basically no say. I mean, you can, a few states have binding openness agreements, but they're never a basis for reevaluating the adoption, right? Once an adoption is legally finalized, that's a permanent legal separation from the birth family. And there's not a way for a relationship to be maintained for the first 18 years unless the adoptive parents are active and willing participants.
And the whole thing is knowledge. Again, be informed. Know why you're doing it. Is there anything else? And that there may be other resources out there that you don't know about. And really, as you've talked about, go in this with all the knowledge that you can. So, Gretchen, the book is Relinquished: The Politics of Adoption and the Privilege of American Motherhood. And unfortunately, the politics of adoption have gotten into our politics in the last couple of years. Where can people find out more information about you and your study?
So the book is available for pre-order anywhere you'd want to buy a book. I also have the website relinquishedbook.com. So you can read more about it there. You can pre-order it there. And it also has a list of all my book events that will be end of February throughout March. So that's where they can find out more.
Gretchen, thank you so much. And thank you for really opening up the conversation on adoption.
Well,
so
thank you.
I want to thank you for being with us here today, or me.
Thanks, Sylvia.
Thank you for joining me today. If you liked what you heard, please share it with another person you think would be interested. And if you haven't already, please subscribe.
This has been a Life of Prey production.